Are you searching for an education that forms not just the mind, but the soul? At Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, we believe learning should be more than just getting a degree. It should be about discovering truth, beauty, and virtue. Located in the beautiful and historic Merrimack Valley, Thomas More College is a Catholic liberal arts college dedicated to the great books and the pursuit of wisdom. But here students don't just study philosophy, theology, literature, history and classical languages. They engage in lively discussions in small, close-knit classes, guided by devoted professors. And they don't just learn about faith, they live it. Through a vibrant Catholic community, daily mass, and a curriculum rooted in the teachings of the Church. Every student at Thomas More College also spends a full semester in Rome, at no extra cost beyond tuition. In the heart of Christendom, they walk the same streets as saints and scholars, study in the shadow of St. Peter's Basilica, and experience Catholic culture in a way that no textbook ever could. If you, or someone you know, is looking for an education that challenges the intellect and nourishes the soul, visit thomasmorecollege.edu to learn more. Thomas More College. Experience more. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashington. Rome is a very exciting place to be this week in particular. It's the week before the papal conclave and 180 cardinals are wandering round talking and listening, consulting, chattering, coordinating, conspiring, clarifying, doing all they can to gain sufficient information to exercise their vote for a new pope in the conclave. Never has there been a more disparate group of cardinals. They hardly know each other. And although mostly they were appointed by the same pope, they were appointed for very different reasons. Some were appointed because they were the best candidate. Others were appointed to humiliate the best candidate when he'd upset Pope Francis. And yet others were appointed because they lived somewhere insignificant and it was time to teach the people who lived somewhere significant a lesson in humility. Guidebooks have been written about the characters of the cardinals, particularly by Ed Pentin and Diane Montagna, and little acts of God have begun to make themselves felt. When the sudden discovery that the cardinal who was the leading papabile had been overcome by heart palpitations and had to call urgent medical attention, a stream of ambulances rushed into the Vatican, and within 5 minutes he moved in the betting stakes from the very top to the very bottom. It's difficult to vote for a dying pope before he's even in office. On these occasions, it's essential to have someone authoritative on the ground you can trust to cut through the rumours, peer through the fog, distill propaganda from truth, and make a serious and reliable assessment. For the Catholic Herald, our former and much esteemed editor, William Cash, is in Rome, and he joins us now. William Cash, thank you so much for joining me. You're in Rome. A lot of people would really love to be in Rome at any time, but especially now. There can hardly be a more interesting time to be in Rome than just before a conclave. I think we'd love to know who you've met and what kind of things they've been saying to you, and so to see what this looks like from the inside. So, William, who have you been talking to?
Well, I spent an hour this morning talking to Jerry Murray, who's a member of the Papal Post and actually written for the Herald. Now, obviously, Jerry is coming from the right, but he is very well informed. He's staying in the guest house of Princess Gloria Ternan Taxis, who's operating a kind of spiritual embassy, I think it's the fair way of explaining it, for cardinals such as Cardinal Müller and Burke and people on the right. So it's a very interesting situation, because as you will remember, Gavin, the Conservatives got a little bit blindsided at the last election with Bergoglio. In fact, the only commentator in the press corps who called Bergoglio at all was the Herald's very own John Allen. But the reality is that it was very much a decision that took people by surprise. And of course, it led to conjecture about this thing called the St. Gallen group or the St. Gallen mafia. Now, this isn't just some sort of conspiracy theory. Austin Ivory, who is, we need no introduction to, has written a book in The Great Reformer in great detail about actually how a group of left-leaning reformisti cardinals decided they really did not want Ratzinger in place, and essentially decided that they would put Bergoglio forward. And there is a really, the really interesting thing which I've been getting from talking to people in the last couple of days is two questions. The first is, there are four liberals who want the crown of Peter, but this has the effect of effectively breaking up the liberals, so they don't have one candidate. And the conservatives, I think, are really thinking, you know, can we put together a consensus candidate that can knock the liberals out? Because they certainly are in the ascendancy at the moment in terms of what I'm hearing. Parolin, for example, has 50 votes already in the bag, according to Italian newspapers.
Extraordinary. Well, if he's got 50 votes in the bag, and there are 120 or 30...
135.
Then he doesn't need very many before he gets his two-thirds majority. So the thing about the Thingala Mafia is we have people like Taylor Marshall calling it a conspiracy. But conspiracy or not, we know perfectly well there was a group of progressive cardinals who wanted Bergoglio. Bergoglio came second to Ratzinger, in fact, the previous time. He was the runner-up, wasn't he?
Well, that's the whole point. Where it gets really interesting in the Thingala Mafia is that they didn't actually get their nominated candidate. But what they did do, and this is this bit's a little bit more controversial, is that, in fact, they put influence on him to step down. So that's the point. But the real question is that, can the Conservatives come up with a candidate that has consensus? And it seems to me, having spoken at some length with Jerry Murray today, and I've been speaking to, I was on a panel here in this hotel where I'm broadcasting from, the Colby Hotel, which is actually named after Saint Maximilian Colby, who is the patron saint of journalism, who actually studied here, edited and wrote his articles from a room literally only 100 yards from where I'm staying now, hence why it's called the Colby Hotel. Yeah. And the point being is that, as I said before, the real question is, you know, can the Conservatives come up with a candidate that is going to appease the progressives? And I suppose the candidate most likely is Peter Erdo. That is the name that I keep hearing. And the interesting thing is, in my time as editor of the Herald, I did meet a fair amount of cardinals. I met Cardinal Pell. He's very interesting, although he's not alive, but his spirit is very much here in the sense of Cardinal Dolan. There is very much a sense that Cardinal Dolan from New York is doing exactly what Cardinal Pell used to do, which is act as a kind of senior figure who is bringing people together. And of course, one of the key things about this conclave is that we have this large number of very young or relatively young cardinals who've never done conclave before. They're frankly a bit wet behind the ears. It's all a bit daunting. And I think one of the really interesting things that's come out of the last 2 days of talking to people is that I had no idea how this week is probably considered to be almost more important in a way than the conclave itself, and that the majority of cardinals actually are going into the conclave pretty much with their minds made up. And the reason for that is that there's a lot of very senior cardinals. The perfect example, of course, is Zen, but we also have some very senior Italians as well, who are in their sort of 80s and 90s, but are veterans and are highly respected. And I was having lunch today with a young priest from the Venerable English College, and he said that the younger generation, they look up to these people and they will be getting steerage. And certainly the Asian cardinals will be looking to Zen. Zen, I didn't think he was going to be coming, but he's been released and he's here and he's going to be a very important figure. So I cannot underestimate the importance of these senior figures who perhaps aren't being written about much in the media, but they have authority and the younger people will look up to them.
Can I try an idea out on you, William? So obviously, Parolin has his 50 votes. They're the die-hard Francis II cardinals, and there's much to play for with all the others. Is there any sense at all that this is not so much a reaction against Pope Francis and his legacy as a complete reconsideration of the project of Vatican II, in the sense that Vatican II set out to make a concordat with secular culture, which in the 1960s looked like it might be a meeting of equals. But in the last 60 years, secular culture has proved anything else but equal, and also it's fairly aggressive towards both Christianity and Catholicism. But in the sort of continuity and discontinuity camps, is there any sense at all that this is a hinge moment for the Catholic Church as it reconsiders the way in which it deals with contemporary culture? And if so, might look for an intelligent cardinal to do it. And one of Erdo's great strengths, of course, is that Hungary is poised geographically or geopolitically right on the sort of the edge of the old Iron Curtain, and has experiences of, if you like, of both sides of the present debate. And he's an immensely intelligent and cultured man. I'm not surprised he's beginning to appeal as a candidate that the non-Francis II cardinals could grow around. So is it a reaction against Francis? Is it reconsideration of Vatican II, or is it simply let's find somebody who isn't Parolin, because Parolin will just be more of what we've been getting in the last 15 years?
Well, so many great points there, Gavin. Okay, so let's deal with the first one. Let's deal with Erdo himself. Now, Erdo is someone actually I spent considerable time with as editor of the Herald. When I went to cover Ukraine, I couldn't get in across the one border, so I got in via Hungary. And actually, Erdo was sort of partly helpful in that, because I went over actually as a member, bizarrely, of the diplomatic corps, the sort of humanitarian aid corps of the Order of Malta. And Erdo had very strong links, and I was able to get an interview for the Herald with him. So I spent 2 hours with Erdo in his sort of palace in Budapest, and got to know him quite well. Now, also, Jerry Murray, who I spoke to today, actually, Erdo was his tutor in Rome in, I believe, moral theology. So we had a good chat. Yeah. So what I took away from Erdo is that he's exactly the sort of pope. He's exactly the sort of person that I think is congenial to both sides, because I think what we're looking for now is someone who is not a sort of roller coaster ride full of surprises, full of sort of holy energy, but full of paradoxes like Francis. They want someone who's going to essentially be, in a way, perhaps a little bit dull. And that word was actually, you know, Father Jerry said dull is good at this stage. He's the right age. He's 72. This cannot be underestimated. There are some very strong contenders, including the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pizzaballa. But he's 60, and that's really considered to be too young. Although, of course, remember, John Paul JP2 was in his 50s. But my point about Erdo is that he's a canon lawyer, and he understands process. And what Jerry Murray said to me today as a former pupil of his was that he was absolutely brilliantly scholastic, academic. He had clarity. And that now brings me on to my next point, because you mentioned about Vatican II, and I had lunch with this wonderful priest from the English College today. And we were talking about this, and the sort of consensus is that we actually regard Francis as a bit of a throwback to the 1960s in a way, because there is a real disconnect between the generation of priests that are coming through. And if the conclave is about the future of the church, they have to be aware of the fact that not just in America, where there's paramount, is that 95% of priests, there is a massive disconnect between the hierarchy and these young priests who are embracing traditionalism, as, for example, this priest that I had lunch with today. And so he said that what people don't want is this sort of Francis idea of, you know, are you okay, or am I not to judge? actually what a lot of people are looking for is clarity. They want moral clarity. They want certainty. They want the beauty. They want to know they are. It's a reaction against relativism, and they want the idea that the Catholic Church stands for these sort of fundamental truths and pillars. I don't know if you've read the article I wrote after Francis died in the Herald, but I talked about when I was editor, it felt as if I was sort of in many ways sort of holding the old gates of the city against the sort of forces of progressivism. And you were one of my sort of strongest foot soldiers, Gavin, holding the gates. And what was really worrying is that I rather felt that the forces against us were actually within the church.
Yes,
when we were, and the old gates, I did say this, were the gates of the city of God, no less. So the stakes, going back to your third point, the stakes could not be higher. I have been speaking to endless people in the last 3 or 4 days, and I've never known a sense of fear and trepidation in terms of there could be almost a schism. We are at an absolute turning point. We are, be under no illusion, this is a battle for the soul of the future of the church. And people like, you know, John Allen, all these people, no one is in denial that this is the most important conclave for several generations.
I'm sure you're right. And there are a number of people who've accompanied me into the Catholic Church in the last, during the papacy of Pope Francis. And one of the ways of managing a longing to join an ordered church with a magisterium, with a pope who seemed to be creating a new magisterium and having a vocation for making a mess, as he said at the outset to a youth group, was how do we manage the cognitive dissonance that paying our respects to the Holy See in that regard creates with the reason we became Catholics in the first place? And we've managed it right to the end. But if there was a Francis II who set out to promote the discontinuity case of Vatican II, intended to demoralize this great generation of JP2 priests who are now in their 40s and their 50s and who have come through, and exactly the ones, as you say, who are asking for doctrinal clarity rather than ambiguity, who want to deal with salvation and not with therapy. I completely agree with you. It would be very hard to manage a second round that was remotely like what we've been going through since 2012. And I don't think it's just the morale of people in the church. I think that we're facing such a moment of civilizational discontent with wokeism having its tentacles around the throat of Western Christendom that I've believed for a long time that only the Catholic Church has the moral authority, the profundity, the depth, the vision, and the resources to deal with this assault on Christendom that we'll call it wokeism, but the progressive anti-Christian liberalism has produced. And if we don't get a pope who can articulate that, then the rest of the world will suffer very badly from our impotence ethically and spiritually. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's one of the great hinge moments of history we're facing.
Well, it's interesting what you say, though, because you use the word Western civilization. And I know, for example, that J.D. Vance, the American vice president, and others have debated this question at places like the Napa Institute. And, you know, it's sort of fashionable to talk about the decline of the West in that respect and how wokeism has created a new sort of secular religion. But I do think we need to be wary of the fact of looking at the church through a particularly Anglo-American lens. And we have to acknowledge the fact that Francis, his whole papacy was about sort of opening up. And I think one of the things that's going to be very interesting is looking at things like, for example, how the Portuguese vote in the conclave. There are 6 Portuguese cardinals, of which 4 are voting. But remember what I said earlier about the importance of just because people can't vote doesn't mean they don't have influence. They speak Portuguese Francis created a very strange and unusual spiritual axis between Lisbon and the Vatican. It was a bit like the special relationship between sort of America and Britain in the war. I think it's because Portugal's always represented a strong Jesuit tradition, but also a bridge between the old world and the new world. Of course, Vasco da Gama in the 16th century discovered this first trade route into India. But what's interesting is that of those four voting cardinals, one of them was in charge of World Youth Day, where 1.5 million Catholics gathered in Lisbon. And they are young, savvy, social media savvy. And these are the sort of blocks that the media, the mainstream media, are not talking about. And you have to remember that Portuguese is also spoken in Brazil. So you actually have 12 Portuguese-speaking cardinals in a block. That's going to be interesting. The Africans have 18. Now, whether they vote as a block is going to be very interesting, but they are, as many people have observed, probably more conservative than perhaps Francis bargained for. And I don't think it's fair to say they're all conservative, but we think about 16 of them are. So I think what's really interesting to me, and I was on a panel with John Allen and some other distinguished Vatican journalists a couple of days ago, was an event organized by CNEWA, the Catholic Near East Welfare Association. And one of the really good points that was made is that people forget that some of these important historic cities or sees like Los Angeles, Venice, Paris, Milan, Dublin, they don't have red hats. They don't have cardinals. And so it's completely different, this conclave, from what's really gone before, because we've got 135, which is a very large number, but none of these great seats like Milan, Paris are represented. So what it's going to do is definitely harden the amount of influence in the Italian Curia. And I've been hearing that there's no question that Parolin, who's the Secretary of State, has been on manoeuvres for at least a year, if not longer. Now, this is the theory that I've been hearing. I know we all know the famous saying that he who enters the conclave as a pope leaves as a cardinal. Now, the point being is that he would be that obvious example. He's highly respected. He's the right age. But the Curia cardinals have much more power and influence this time round because of the reasons I just outlined, which is that these other important historic cities don't necessarily have representation. However, where the plot thickens is I'm hearing that he is in a way a Trojan horse for the fact that it's likely that people might, the conservatives might not be entirely happy about the fact that he could be seen as a Francis II continuation candidate, and that actually the left have got another candidate up their sleeve, a bit like they have Bergoglio. And what I'm hearing is that candidate is Tagle. So we shall see, but it is a geopolitical chess game. And unquestionably, it is very foolish to try and predict, because as we've seen with so many conclaves, there are so many surprises.
Well, some of the things you said are very interesting, and again, it's hard to know which ones to pick out at the top. I'm very interested about the idea that you said that Francis somehow opened things up. He doesn't seem to have created a legacy of support amongst the South American Catholics. I mean, famously never went back to Argentina again for reasons we can only speculate over. But he seems to have ambiguity in his wake over that. I'm very interested in the idea that the Lisbon Cardinals might provide a block that is equivalent of the African ones. But the problem with Tully is he's poor man has just suffered a TikTok video of it going around with him singing the lyrics of John Lennon, which although they catch the public imagination, they're execrably anti-Christian. Imagine there's no heaven. It's not an easy thing to do. To have, I can't but imagine that any candidate who's in this age with social media, who's suffered the humiliation of being seen to sing like that, can really stand much of it. Or do you think that's just I'm being too teenage in my evaluation of TikTok?
Well, my view is that you know, I do think there is, I think the funeral was a very interesting symbolic act in its own way, because Benedict's funeral, Emeritus Benedict, was deliberately downplayed. I've been talking to various ambassadors, and they were really rather dazzled by the turnout with all the heads of state and royalty. And what I didn't realize is that actually heads of state were actively encouraged by the Vatican not to send their top people. I mean, I know he obviously wasn't Pope. So I think the funeral was an incredible service. The music was incredible. There were some very interesting pointers, but I think it did quite a lot of good for the Francis camp. And I have to say, you know, I was very moved by it. And I think a lot of people, you know, would say it was a good advertisement for the Catholic faith. So one mustn't underestimate the fact that in Rome itself, you know, we mustn't view things through this sort of Anglo conservative lens, which sees things rather differently. I've spent an hour or so queuing to see the tomb of Francis 2 days ago. I was struck by the amount of people who had flown over from America in particular. And the queues were absolutely enormous. And everyone I spoke to said they tried to get in to pay their respects to his body lying in state. And so, you know, the reality is that, you know, we sometimes think that, you know, Francis, you know, wasn't, you know, necessarily that popular with American Catholics. But actually, my experience of being here this week is that he did have a very large following. There's certain some people who are critical, but I think that his brand of holiness, you know, was actually very infectious to a lot of people. And I actually spoke to someone at an event today who was part of a big American donor organization who touched his hand at a papal audience. And he said it changed his entire life. And that he then went up and set up a foundation in America that's given large amounts of money. So, you know, I've come away with in this last week is that I think it's simply not true to say that there is this sort of big desire to totally dismantle the Francis legacy. So I think what we're going to looking for is what people are desperate for is they don't want a long conclave, because that will look like the church is divided. You're going to have, you know, 1,000 or more media camped out pretty much in St. Peter's Square. And the last messaging anyone wants is that the church can't decide on anything. They're at war with each other. So I think there's going to be a real drive from some of the elder statesmen to have a fairly quick conclave and to try and get a unity candidate that isn't going to tear the church apart. And I think that's going to be absolutely crucial. So they're going to, that's why it's possible Erdo could be the man, for the reasons I outlined, in that, you know, he's knows the Vatican Cura. He was head of the Bishops' Conference in Europe. He once told me, by the way, totally incidentally, Gavin, that I said, how good's your English? Because we had a translator. He would sometimes come out in English. And I said, you know, your English really isn't bad, Your Eminence. And he then laughed at one point and said, actually, you know what, I spent some time at a language school in Plymouth and became very fond of English fish and chips, which I also really enjoy English pubs. So I thought that was rather nice.
Well, it sounds as though we have an associate Englishman, even if Cardinal Nicholls doesn't get elected or Father Radcliffe fails to make it for the progressive vote, then at least we have an associate a Pope in Bishop, in Cardinal Erdo. William, it sounds as though you've covered all the bases. I mean, this is so first of all, you've given us someone to bet on. It sounds, as you quite rightly say, that they're going to look for somebody who can exercise the papacy without causing more trauma. And if Erdo, as you suggest, appeals to the progressives as well as to the conservatives, then it might not be a long conclave after all.
Well, there is a theory that I've been hearing, which is that, as you probably know, Gavin, Parolin was very much not Francis's preferred choice. The reason is that there were some things that happened that Parolin made some comments which upset Francis. The theory is that he did this deliberately to try and make out that he wasn't a mere puppet of Francis, and that, as I say, he's been sort of plotting with his people for about a year now. The favoured candidate of Francis is actually the Archbishop of Marseille, and that's also an interesting one because he's strong on interfaith dialogue. That was John Allen's tip. Now, John actually was pretty much the only Vatican press correspondent who tipped Bergoglio, and we did put him on the spot on this panel, which was sponsored by Kanewa. And he also said that the Cardinal from Marseille was a really possible, sort of dark horse bet, so to speak. So that's that. I'm afraid to say I don't think the English cardinals or the Americans have got much of a chance. But what I think is important, though, as I said earlier, is that I think Cardinal Dolan of New York is going to be very important in terms of someone who can perhaps put, the African Catholics, I think, would look to America. They're quite conservative. They'd look to a figure like Dolan as someone who they would respect and listen to. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see how these blocks vote. That's my view.
It sounds as though what you're saying, William, is that the Liberals are quite as capable of suffering from a split candidature as the, I don't want to call them the Conservatives, but what language should we be using in terms of, we don't want to use left and right, we don't want to use progressive and conservative.
It's a really, really good question. And Cardinal Müller, and actually progressives as well, don't like this division. I think that's right. People will talk about orthodoxy and traditional. And even Cardinal Dolan has said he'd like to see, I think, a return to a more traditional pope. So I think the word traditional is probably good. I think that there is unquestionably going to be some serious issues relating to, what are the main voting points that the cardinals are going to look at? And I think they've got to look at the future of the church globally. They can't look at it just through a American lens, which we tend to slightly the Catholic Herald. And I think that, as I said, this Portuguese bloc is going to be important. And I think that we're going to hear a lot from the Africans. That's my personal view.
I'd love to know if you've picked up anything about the Latin Mass and the extent to which the prohibition, the effective prohibition of Latin Mass in most places at most times, has become an issue. Obviously, for traditionalists, it's not just an issue; it's almost the issue. And although they're small, there are quite a lot of them, and everyone makes a great deal of the fact that Generation Z are flocking to the Latin Mass. Again, the impetus and the direction are probably more significant than the numbers. But has this made its way through to the gossipers, the talkers, the electors? Is this an issue that they're going to be taking into consideration?
Yeah, I've discussed this with various people, and you're absolutely right. It's one of these very strange issues that, it's a sort of litmus test. It's one of these things that where people stand on Latin Mass tells you pretty much everything you need to know about them. And so, interestingly, people are being very careful where they stand on it. I think I'm right in saying, I asked a senior person about this in relation to Parolin, because the interesting thing is that there was this... there was this letter, as we know, that went out to try and influence Francis. I think it's called the Agatha Christie II letter. And arguing that the Latin Mass was, to do with Western civilization and that, it was something that was absolutely crucial to the sort of ferment of art, not just purely in a religious context. And what was interesting is that I heard on pretty good authority that Francis has sort of made up his mind that last July he was going to essentially ban it through Roche, the Yorkshireman, but it didn't happen. There was a sort of stay of execution. And I think that a lot of people would be very relieved about that. And I would think it would be very dangerous indeed, for a progressive candidate to start saying that that's the first thing he would do would be to sort of to ban it or to do anything. So I think we're going to see quite a lot of backpedaling in that department.
My backpedaling amongst the progressives, is there an equal...
I say backpedaling, I really mean more perhaps obfuscation or diplomatic kicking into the dust. I don't think it's the sort of issue that you would want to be fighting the election on.
And on the traditionalist side, is there an equivalent embrace of the rights of the Latin mass?
To be honest with you, we know that Mueller, for example, is a strong proponent. And in fact, as you probably know, I'm pretty sure I'm right in this, he celebrated Mass at the Chartres pilgrimage last year, which, as you know, is a rather punitive pilgrimage from Paris to Chartres. I believe it's roughly 80 kilometres in 2 days or something, and very much...
2 days, yes.
Yeah, very much a sort of Latin mass orientated. And I believe, you know, Mueller was there. And, I heard rumours that, you know, under Francis, you know, there were 30,000 pilgrims doing it. And I've actually signed up to do it this year, which you only have to look at me on this video to realise that it's quite an ask. And I read a wonderful article by Joseph Shaw, who's the... president or chairman of the Latin Mass, president, I think, of the Latin Mass Society. And I looked up his age, and Joseph's actually, I think, in his early 50s. And he said he's done it 4 times and he's only managed to complete it twice. So I am very much dreading it. But my point is that 30,000 young Catholics, or not just young, that is enormous and growing. And I'll tell you something, Gavin, I've got friends who wanted to go this year. And you had to register on Palm Sunday. And I think registration was full by literally within 24 hours. Can you imagine 30,000 people wanting to do that because they believe it's so important? That's a worrying thing for progressives, because it goes back to the point that we were talking earlier of this lovely English priest I was talking to for lunch today. Oh, and I must mention one thing. We went and had lunch in this restaurant in quite close to the Vec. And it actually was the same restaurant where Bergoglio was actually taken for dinner, apparently, when he was told that he was being put forward by the St. Gallen group. This was always disputed. So I thought, in the tradition of good Catholic journalism, I should, one, go and have a good lunch, and two, should make a point of asking the owner if this was true, which is exactly what I did today with this priest from the Vec. And the owner of the restaurant said absolutely it was true. He was there, and it was actually, bizarrely, the British Cardinal Cormac, who took him out and was a member of the Gallen group, as you know. Yes. So I thought that was a little bit of useful, well-directed research.
I love the idea that the journalist's pilgrimage route includes as many restaurants as it does churches.
That's actually a good point in itself, because what's really happening, and going back to my original point, is that I had no idea that this week is really where the decisions are made.
And the restaurants are where the kind of pre-conclave... Because the arena is the restaurants of Rome, yes.
And it's the trattorias, exactly, not so much around the Vatican, but more around where the Vec is, Via Monferrata, Piazza Navona. They are literally teeming with cardinals having lunches and dinners. And, you know, it's very Italian. But, you know, this is no change from as it has been for centuries.
William, you're clearly the right man in the right place at the right time. And I must say, I don't often feel jealous, but I've got a few twinges of both of envy and admiration. Well, it's wonderful that you're there. And are you going to see the whole process through right to the vote?
Well, no, exactly. I'm actually leaving tomorrow, and then I'm going to come back for the conclave itself. And I'm writing for various people, and I have to say, and I think as we discussed in this podcast, I think the sense of sort of that we are on this sort of edge of the cliff is so much that I think to be there really is going to be, you know, quite important. And I really can't prophesize who it's going to be. I'm rather hoping it will be Erdo, but it could easily be a complete shock. We just don't know.
Well, I hope there might be an opportunity for us to reflect further on the other side of the conclave. William Cash, thank you so much for spending the time with us. Your audience will be very grateful, and it's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it so much. Bless you. Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin. Lovely to see you again.